at Mount Vernon at noon at the Lincoln Theater, Sunday in Eugene, Oregon, University of Oregon, and in Portland at 7:30 at the Aladdin Theater. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. A very special belated happy birthday to Dennis Moynihan. And special thanks to the staff and student crew here at Bellevue College, Steve Ramsey, Rick Oddie, Ruthie Bly, Samer El-Shamari, Evan Tillett, Ellison Shea, Judy Lindsay Kalma, Bob Nash, Ellison Shea, Gary Goto, Deepa Tom. Thanks to Laura Gottesdiener. I'm Amy Goodman. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Blue Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the United States premiere of Liza, 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 produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Join Liza Minnelli at three different stages of her life, often all on stage at the same time with plenty of songs, backstories about the iconic and troubled daughter of Judy Garland, with a bit of dancing and prancing and much humor among the frightening tales of drink, drug abuse, broken legs, strokes, and hip replacements. Again, that's Liza, 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 May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 o'clock. Next up, Positively Revolting.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Pan-African Film Series. This month, May 18th at 6 p.m., will be A Message from Women in Gambia at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University. A Message from the Women of Gambia will feature young women organizers from the All African Women's Revolutionary Union and the All African People's Revolutionary Party speaking about organizing for Pan-Africanism in Gambia and throughout Africa. Again, that's a message from the Women of Gambia, a part of the Pan-African Film Festival, Wednesday, May 18th at 6 p.m. at the Smith Student Union Room 333 at PSU, 1826 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning, Portland. If you can, you can hear me. Okay, that's good. Good morning. We are, this is your very own radio station, KBOO in Portland. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Lynn,
And I'm Ani.
And I'm here with my friend Ani. Yes, yes, yes. And this morning we are very pleased to welcome back to Positively Revolting our friend, I think we can say, friend of our show, Michael Mead, who Michael is a renowned storyteller, author, scholar of mythology, anthropology, psychology. He combines storytelling and kind of street-savvy perceptiveness with spellbinding interpretations of ancient myths, deep knowledge of cross-cultural rituals. He has a really interesting ability to distill and synthesize these disciplines, tapping into ancestral sources of wisdom and connecting them to the stories that we're living today. He is the founder of the Multicultural Foundation, which I always say they work with at-risk humans of all kinds. I like to say it that way. He is also the author of many books, Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements of the Soul, Why the World Doesn't End, The Water of Life, Initiation, and The Tempering of the Soul, to name a few. And this morning we're here to speak with him about his new book, which is The Myth of Genius. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Lynn. Good morning, Ani.
How are you this fine morning?
Yeah, great morning.
It is lovely here in the Pacific Northwest. We're going to talk about genius. And one of the things, you know, Prince just died and they kept talking about what a genius he was. And when people speak about genius sometimes, one of the things that I think about is how isolating and rarefied it is sort of defined in Western culture. It's like bad behavior. Oh, well, you know, he's a genius. That's just how it goes. And the Mensa Club is for people with very high IQs and just them. And you seem to have kind of a more egalitarian view of what genius means. Am I correct with that?
You're totally correct. And actually, you know, of course, Prince was a genius and even kind of gave himself royalty, too, as if to say, I need to somehow name what is inhabiting me. But part of the isolation, I think, happens because people think, oh, he's a genius, and the rest of us, you know, just have to keep marching. And whereas genius is, first of all, it's a very old word, and it means the spirit that's already there. That's one of the meanings of it. And another crucial meaning of it is that which is just born. So the genius myth is about the idea that everybody is born with a spirit that is already there. Everybody is just born, and with them is born their natural genius. So genius is like the spirit a person has for their particular life. The other thing about the old meaning of the word is it's related to the uniqueness of a person. So the job isn't to fit in somewhere. We have to do that for social reasons. But what fulfills the soul is the idea that I have lived out what is trying to live through me. And so, you know, Prince did that to a very large degree, but he did it in a cultural situation where you can become very isolated with your genius or with your success or with your failure or with your depression, because it isn't understood that we're here, each of us, on kind of a unique mission to deliver something that the world needs. And so someone said to me, why genius, why now? And I said, well, right now, what we need is everybody's genius.
Mm-hmm.
Some have a genius for music, but then some people use their genius for music to make life better for everybody, or to make life more understandable or more beautiful or deeper. Someone else's genius, they instinctively know what the trees need. Someone else has some idea on how to invent something that will take the place of coal, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. And so what I'm saying is, given the fact that culture is unraveling, politics is, you know, we don't even know what's going to happen next, but also nature is disturbed. The fires in Alberta, all the big storms, everybody's genius, which has its own direction and its own reason for being alive, is being called on right now, or it could be called on. And so in the book I even say, nature only makes originals.
Mm-hmm.
And what if nature is calling now on all of us to find a genius way of contributing to the world? And so the book is also about reimagining the world.
Well, and I think that let's explore a little bit more about the individual genius and how one actually can unlock it. Because, you know, I think Lynn and I could not agree more that this is the time that is we are all called to really be our most authentic selves, seated in the center of our power, because we have a lot of challenges to face.
Yeah.
And the only way through this is by being in our full power and getting through it together. And you talk about genius coming in vertically, that it results from a person actually being connected to their place on the earth and open to the inspiration and connectedness from the sky, and being sort of a conduit or channel for those energies to work through. And you talk about this in comparison to a more horizontal view of interconnected knowledge, more knowledge with each other than that individual inspiration connection of sky and earth. Can you explore that a little more?
So I'm taking the old idea that humans inhabit the space between the earth and, they used to call it heaven, call it the cosmos, the Milky Way, whatever the vertical up mm-hmm. part is for a person. So that our feet, they used to say our feet walk the goat's earth, and our heads are in the top of the sky, where ideas form and fall down, you know, because everything comes down to earth. And so I'm trying to get a what they used to call vertical imagination. So one of the interesting things that happened now is everybody's interconnected, and it's now called, you know, the global community. And the problem is those interconnections are primarily horizontal. So in a certain sense, the earth has become flat again, or our world has become flat again, as all the energy is going into horizontal connection, but also the ideas have fallen flat. You could not have the kind of foolishness going on in American politics if it already hadn't collapsed down to everybody thinking it's all about economics.
Mm-hmm.
That's a collapse of imagination. What happened to the human imagining that was up high in the sky? And so I'm using genius, and this whole started, like you mentioned, with working with severely at-risk people. And how do you talk to someone who thinks they're going to die and even thinks they should die? What do you say to them? The old thing of saying, well, it'll get better. If someone's in despair, they don't think it's going to get better.
Right.
Well, or what's the politics now? It's like, what do we want? Incremental change? When do we want it? I don't know.
know? Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And so the background idea is that the trouble we're in is only going to get deeper.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're living through now a period of tremendous transition that has way more to do with what the political parties think is going on. It actually has to do with the earth. It has to do with, you know, just tremendous forces. So in the midst of the transition, which is often a turmoil, how does a person orient? You know, how does a current Republican orient when the whole party just got hijacked? And the thing is, that's not the beginning of the problem. That's the indication of the nature of the problems. So I'm saying one of the few things you can orient to is the idea that each of us came here with a distinct kind of spirit for living. And so if everything goes to hell, you know, in many, many horizontal hand baskets, I want to be breathing and living with what brought me to life. If everything gets better, I want to be breathing and living with what brought me to life. So I have to, in the book, explain that people don't come into life as a blank slate, which is one of the ideas that has permeated the culture. And I'm taking the old idea that that seed of genius is not just an indication of the gift a person has to give, but it's an indication of the way they're oriented in the world and what their purpose in life is. And so part of it was thinking about the younger people, you know, having to grow up in a world that seems to be falling apart right in front of everybody, and what do they orient to? How can they orient? You don't know if you're going to have a job. You don't even know where the economy might be 6 months from now. So I'm saying, let's go back to the very old idea that inside ourselves is an orientation waiting to be found, and particularly inside ourselves is the gifts that we brought to give. And again, right there, I'm going against the idea of the consumer culture, and that we become the gift givers and the healers and the people who are seeking wisdom, and that's our job.
We are the people we need. We have our solutions within.
And we are uniquely so. So that's the other thing. You know, someone asked me the other day, how do you explain this kind of support for someone like Donald Trump? And one explanation is people who don't know who they really are inside will support someone who tells them that they're going to be better.
Right.
And call it truth. It's so interesting.
Just to remind everyone, you're listening to Positively Revolting on KBOO, your very, very own community radio station. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we are delighted to have Michael Mead with us by phone this morning. Please, you can call in with your very own questions. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. 503-231-8187. You can also check out our Positively Revolting page on Facebook. Like us there. And in the Twitters, you can follow along at Positive Revolt.
And I just want to remind people that Michael is going to be in Portland on Wednesday, May 18th. He's going to be at the First Unitarian Church, which is 1034 Southwest 13th at, I believe it's like 7 or 7:30.
7 o'clock.
7 o'clock. If you haven't seen Michael live, just like Prince, he's great. It's always, you never know what the evening will hold, do you, Michael? But it's always riveting and fun. And many their stories are told. Poetry is happening. You know, I don't know if it's too long a story to tell, but the one chapter in the book about when you really decided that genius was something you were going to have to explore, when you went into, sounded like South Central LA, where there was a gang war about to happen, and you were going to be a mediator, and you got an initiation yourself that night, didn't you? Anyway, if you want to, I don't know if it's too long to tell, if you'd care to talk about it at all, but it's a great story.
So it was actually Chicago.
Oh, it was Chicago. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, and I didn't put certain stories in the book. I don't put, you know, the place, because in a way, that place is another. It is in South Central. It is in East Oakland,
right.
And so I'm telling it more like a folk story than I am like a news story. But yeah, I had been working with some OGs, some, you know, original gangsters or old gangsters who have matriculated out of the gangs, and now they're going, oh my God, you know, we better do something to save the neighborhood. And so they invited me to come to help with a truce, making a truce. And it was two you know, local street gangs and who had been shooting at each other and things like that. And so I arrived, someone picks me up at the airport and drives me to a recreation center in, you know, one of the worst parts of town, and pulls up at the curb and says, listen, I don't want to even sit here in the car, so would you just get your stuff and good luck? And so that's when I started to realize, well, maybe this is dangerous. And so I go in, and they're waiting for me to come in and talk to these members of two gangs. And so just to be clear, there's no one, there's no one checking for weapons at the door, so they're actually armed. And they have been shooting each other. And I walk in, and they say, oh, here he is. and I have to figure out what to do. And so the fortunate thing is I carry a drum and, you know, have a quiver full of stories. And so I just started telling a story. And the story that came into my mind is a Native American story that I call The Deserted Children, because it's about when a tribe leaves their traditional village and goes off looking for greener grasses, and they happen to leave behind a sister and a brother who were out picking berries. So the two children inhabit this deserted village, and they have to figure out how to live on their own. And what happens in a way is the brother becomes moody and kind of internal, and he becomes angry and resentful and everything. And whenever he looks up, whatever he looks at dies. And then the sister kind of takes on the other side of this situation, and she becomes kind of brilliant and magical. And so she says to him one day, look up, little brother, here comes the buffalo. He looks up, and just by looking at them, the buffalo die. But then she figures out how to turn that into food and teepees and all that kind of stuff. So I'm telling the story, and then I stop and I say, you know, what do you think? and fortunately, someone said, well, aren't we the deserted children? Aren't all the houses, or half the houses around here, empty? Aren't all the businesses closed? Haven't people left looking for greener pasture and left us here? And then someone fortunately said, and aren't we looking at each other with the killing stare? And that was the opportunity to really open up the fact that both gangs were made of little brothers who had a killing stare, and they were staring at each other. They were killing, as often happens. They were really twins of the same desertion, mm-hmm. kind of taking it out on each other. And so we spent the rest of that day in the story talking about, and so what happened then was someone said, well, how is it that this sister has all this magical ability when there's no one there to even teach them anything? And I said, oh, well, that's what genius really means, when you have your gift. Because genius comes full-blown. It doesn't need to go to school. And so all of a sudden I realized, wow, talking about genius is a way to balance the deep wound of anyone who's abandoned, deserted, or oppressed. And that began a conversation that's been going on for years in communities all over the country.
Well, and don't older people owe younger people the telling them what their genius is, not telling them, but letting them know what their genius is and sort of reflecting that back for them?
Yeah.
Well, in a perfect world, yeah.
Well, I know. No, I'm just saying, well, I know it doesn't happen. I'm just saying that that's just so incredibly important for people to get a sense of who they are. You can't just do that in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
It is so important that it transcends other things. I was the only white person in that room.
Not surprised.
And what happened, though, is because I had a story to tell, because the story resonated with the, you know, crushing life experience of everyone in the room, then I became that person that could be compassionately listening, but also blessing the genius in them. And that's how important it is, that it transcends all the things that we think, like age, like gender, like social status, all the things that we think are the things of the world. This deep need to be recognized as a unique human being with a gift to give is so important, it transcends all that. And so that's the beauty of it. And so then we were still in the really, really rough neighborhood. But we had found something that kind of gave us a deeper village. I'm still connected with a number of those people. And I'm glad to say a number of them have survived. I also have to tell the truth and say some of them died young.
Right.
That's part of that road. But it helped me understand in the midst of whatever, a depression, in the midst of a riot, in the midst of a dance, in the midst of a chaos, if I know who I am, I'm much less likely to step in the, to be so disoriented that I hurt myself or hurt someone else. And it doesn't solve everything, but to me it's the possible beginning of how to reimagine a world where, you know, look at what's going on in North Carolina. You know, you have the wonderful thing of people saying, I'm transgender, or I'm inventing a new angle on gender. And the idea that that person trying to be seen a certain way, if it was understood that that could be their genius, that from that genius place, something could be delivered to the world that doesn't exist now, that's terribly important. And I think on the other side, too, young people growing up and saying, what in the world is going on? Could really, I've seen how much they benefit from getting, awakening the sense of themselves that knows, you know, I'm here for a reason, and I'm going to figure that out. And that may involve years of college, and it may involve me going to learn something to do with my hands or something else, because there's a section in the book also about the education of genius rather than the giving everybody the same education. Bringing the education that's needed to the person whose genius is awakening. So I take a shot at reimagining education as well.
Well, and about that sameness. So it seems to me to really live our genius, to have our genius present, and to do our individual parts in being a part of the solution to the challenges we face together in this world of climate disruption, of social injustice, of so much despair and dysfunctionality, that as we are called to recognize our individual genius, the status quo is really kind of threatened by the idea of people being individuals, right? And our education system, our work systems, and so much of our family systems are really geared towards making us same. Fit in, be the cog, be the consumer, be good, stay in line. You know, I was raised British, you know, go along to get along, you know.
Mustn't grumble,
don't stand out. You know, you just want your quiet life. Anything for the quiet life is like the motto of the family, right? And so there's this dynamic tension between that which society is sort of, you know, cookie cutter shaping us into, you know, we are all individuals with the stamp of approval. And then there's the true and authentic self. And as we see the struggle to become our true and authentic selves, to live in ways that are not just going to consistently sort of go towards a Eurocentric norm, not consistently, you know, where we can be brilliant, we can be who we are from our cultures, we can be who we are artistically, we can be who we are in our sexual expressions and our gender expressions, we can be who we are. And we're seeing this real tension sort of coming to a head, especially in this political milieu right now, where these things are sort of being, you know, used as footballs.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think we're headed into a very troubled summer.
Yeah.
And, you know, summer is traditionally when things heat up.
And all summers seem to be getting hotter every year.
They're getting hotter every year.
Physically and metaphorically.
Yeah.
Exactly. They may be getting culturally hotter right now. And so having grown up, you know, lived through the 60s and learned something about what happens when injustice and social unrest and all boils up and spills over, there's a really important thing in there, because some of the greatest ideals that were served openly in the 60s collapsed for a couple of reasons, many reasons, but what couple that I'm interested in: lack of elders who actually understood how to sustain something and not get co-opted. But another thing was that in the midst of a protest, a person has to know who they are in that protest. In other words, you get pulled along by the waves of cultural change, which have already, you know, are already in motion in our situation right now. And that's fine, and especially if a person is allows themselves to be pulled into places of meaningful change. But the important thing in life is still to know, who am I doing this? Because it's in the midst of cultural change that a person can realize what they actually have to give. And I just want to turn it one more way. In the beginning of the book, I have to say something that it, as far as I can tell, is not only true but very important. Everybody has a calling. That the old word was vocation. But what the calling is calling to is the genius in a person. And the idea of awakening this sense of a specific, distinct spirit for life is so important that the calling keeps calling. And it doesn't matter how old a person gets, they are still within one breath of realizing in a greater way why they're here. And so I'm using the idea of genius and the continuing calling to awaken to one's genius and gift and all that stuff as a way of imagining the elders awakening in the culture. Because you cannot, in a sense, redirect the energies of politics through people who are trying to manipulate those energies. You redirect it by having elders who say, okay, you know, let's get honest here, or let's get smarter here.
Excellent. So we've got a caller, Michael.
Okay.
let's also go ahead and give out that number again.
Oh, yes.
If you are also wanting to call and join in the conversation this morning, you can call us at 503-231-8185.
I told you the calling keeps calling.
503-231-8187. You can also follow along on Facebook. Like our page, Positively Revolting, on Facebook. In the Twitterverse, we are at Positive Revolt. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. How are you? Thank you so much for having me.
Doing well. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. Michael, I really appreciate your words. They really touch a place in my heart. And I think that I am 99% in agreement with you. The beauty that we have here on Earth doesn't change. It's still here. We just have to keep our eyes open. I'm in complete agreement with that. That genius within all of us is a beautiful thing, and it's our duty to help each other share that with others and to recognize it in ourselves. I'm in a very interesting position, and I think a lot of supporters of the 2012 Ron Paul campaign are. I was a Yamhill County coordinator in that campaign where essentially our the direction that we were trying to take the Republican Party with the Tea Party and everything was co-opted. And you have folks like Ted Cruz that are all of a sudden the face of movement, which is very similar to, I think, Bernie's movement, ending the corruption that we're experiencing here in our country and also across the world. And as a supporter of the idea of opening up that corruption that we're experiencing right now, I'm in a place where I am completely supportive of whatever figure comes to the forefront in on the Democratic side or the Republican side, the two major party systems, to shine a spotlight on that corruption that we're all experiencing. And as you know, I'm a Republican. I've been a Republican for 8 years, and that was for my support and me looking up to a father figure in Ron Paul and trying to end these endless wars and to shine a light on the
Nick,
Federal Reserve.
Do you have a question?
I have a question. Yeah, I feel like there's this opportunity here to maybe not label all Trump supporters as folks that are have been hurt and are looking for a simple solution in an individual that's running for office. I think it's more of an opportunity.
Okay, well, let's let Michael answer that. How about that?
Okay, yeah.
Thanks. Thanks very much, Nick.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So I don't know it's about labeling. I would turn a little bit more to psychology.
Mm-hmm.
Like, America still doesn't operate with psychological awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can separate two things. You have a culture that's rapidly changing, And then you have people, we know about the lost jobs and the collapse from, you know, well-paying jobs into, you know, lower-paying jobs, all that kind of stuff, the flattening of the earning power that's been going on for three decades. That stuff can all be figured out. And so that's one thing, and that should bring people closer together. But I just have to say, from a psychological point of view, just looking and not simply labeling, but watching Donald Trump, he is not able to heal or bring things together or deliver the things he's promising. I mean, I think it would just be a smart thing to realize it's the art of the deal being done on a national level. And, I mean, bait and switch and everything that's ever been done in order to manipulate people is already underway. And that's all problematic. I think it's a problem that people can't see. The very people who are saying we have been betrayed are rallying behind someone who will do a betrayal on a scale that they have not yet imagined. So that's one thing. And I think that's not labeling simply, and it's not simply politics. I would say that's psychology. But watching what someone does and watching how they do it. But I think there's another issue, which is a twofold thing. One is the bigotry and the racism, which goes back in the Trump family, and which when he's using phrases that people that know history understand, like America First and all that, those are phrases from the history of racial politics. But married to that is some kind of an intrigue with power and its connection to violence. And when I say I have some concerns about the summer coming up, when you have a person handling power who does not understand the nature of that power, how people can get hurt, how the wrong thing said at a given moment can trigger certain things, then you have a great danger. And I think that's what I'm seeing. As a person who lived through the 60s and was part of political things at that time and really watched carefully what people are doing with power when they have the opportunity to do something, I'm afraid that Donald Trump is caught in something he thinks he can control, which he cannot. And so let me just step back then from the psychology to the mythology. We're living in a time where there is a churning going on in the world. And part of the churning, if you imagine at the depths of the ocean, there's creatures down there that, you know, are very rarely seen, and some of them are really big, literally, in Puget Sound, the biggest octopi in the world are down there, and they're never really seen. But when a cultural change happens, a churning happens, then it's the deep emotions that are down there, the kind of surprising extremes of hatred and fear. Those things get stirred, and they come up through people. And I think that's part of what's underway. And someone who wants to play or manipulate or you know, those kind of things is going to be quite surprised as to what can happen. And so that's why I think more in terms of elders than political figures, because elders are unelected people that are intending to serve the greater good rather than people trying to get elected for their own good.
So what can voters, what can citizens do, Bernie supporters, Trump supporters, people that are feeling like something has to be done, and whether they're aware of the ins and outs of the system is besides the point, but what can we do in this election cycle to build momentum in a movement where we are actually seeing past the left and right paradigm and getting beyond that?
Well, you know, I'm not going to say there's an easy answer to that. I'm not sure. The part that I decided to focus on is how do I know that I'm really myself being authentic? How do I make sure I keep in touch with that? Because I don't know that there is a simple predetermined movement. I really think something else is going on, that you realize what has happened by now, just politically speaking. You have both parties kind of having surges of popularism into both parties, and you have both parties splitting. And that's what I'm trying to say is what we're living through. So for a minute, to step away from the idea that it's going to be solved by politics, when politics is actually, it's like the sea being disturbed by the churning. And so, I mean, watch what's happening. I mean, at first it was that the Republicans were going to have a broken convention, and now it's that the Democrats might have one. And what that means psychologically, and I would say even mythologically, is that with all the cracks in the culture, all the potential splits are going to get activated, and I think we're going to live through a time that's much more complicated than the history of politics. And so I'm trying to figure out how do we live through that while maintaining ideas that are progressive in terms of cultural healing and all. And then I want to go back to my little angle, which is the changes that we need are more likely to occur if many, many people are doing meaningful work where they live than they will occur right now by a political movement.
Thanks, Nick.
And I wanted to sort of hop in for... Well, first of all, I think that last sentence is really profound, and we might want to explore that in another minute or two. That it's really a call for local action in knowing where you are, your interconnectedness with your community, your ability to be responsive, and your ability to do right action according to your own genius, right? I mean, that's sort of summing that up rather than worrying about a broad-based political national sort of thing, looking at where you're at and what impact you can have there.
That's how I'm imagining it. And I follow politics. It's a big part of my life. And but my sense is that the changes are so big that it's very hard for the very people on the waves of political movement to understand what's happening. And I keep watching the people that get the opportunity to stand in the middle of these surges of power. I mean, it's great that people are coming out for rallies and all that, because that exhibits signs of engagement. But I keep watching for what I would call genuine leadership, because what happens is an ideology cannot make a movement. Not a real movement. A real movement arises from somewhere inside the earth, and it comes up into people. It's an expression of something that transcends ideology. Ideology, to me, is what people grab a hold of when they don't have real vision. So I keep watching for anyone in that milieu who starts to act like a wise person, or act like a person with a genuine vision. And my guess, having been around for a while, is it's not going to happen there, and it's not going to come from there. And there's an old idea called the genius loci, the genius of the local place. And I have a feeling that the real changes in the culture are arising where people live in a specific place and figure out how to give their genius qualities, their gifts and their energies and their vision to that local place. And there might be a dynamic now where local has more valence than national.
Yeah, you are not the only person thinking that. I know some folks here in Portland who are just focusing on local politics, as well as folks that feel that way about food and many things. So...
And before we move on, I want to get back and check out one other thing you said back there about one who, I mean, you were saying this specifically about Trump, but I think it certainly would apply to Trump and so many others who believe that they can bring up this surge of power and that they can control it, but that in fact it is not so controllable and in fact end up getting controlled by it often as not. And that, you know, couldn't pass up the chance to say, wow, you scholar of mythology. I mean, how many times do we see that as a central theme of, you know, unloosing the demon, trying to control the demon, and suddenly, whoops, the demon jumps the circle?
Well, yeah. I mean, for some reason, I thought of Altamont.
Oh, wow, you know, yeah.
Which was the end of the 60s.
You got to explain that to some people.
Well, so the Rolling Stones, who are, you know, remarkable bands, still going, but were known.
Trump's stealing their music, by the way.
What?
Trump has been stealing their music. They told him to stop it.
Yeah. I'm telling you.
I know.
Some people don't know what they're doing.
I know.
And the Rolling Stones, who were known for their financial savvy, you know, mm-hmm. Mick Jagger is like a financial genius besides, you know, having his musical gifts and so on, and his stage presence. And so they finally decided to give a free concert, which they never did. And so so they have this huge concert out in the field, and someone decides to hire the Hell's Angels as the security group, which, you know, even just saying the sentence, someone should say, wait a minute, you know, is this really likely to give us security? And so, you know, of course, what happened tragically is someone was killed right in front of the stage.
Right.
But the reason I think of it is, as someone who's on stage a lot, you feel the power that gathers when a group of people come together. And if you're a musician or an artist, you know, you learn to ride that energy or to try to channel it or something. And I watched that happening. It's happening to Bernie as well as Trump. And it's quite amazing. It fills you with vitality. And it actually also inflates your psyche, and in some cases, your ego. And the trick of being in that position, which is a position that people have been throughout history for all kinds of reasons, just at a tribal level or now in this horizontal connection where you can be seen as a powerful person throughout the world. But when you're in that spot, there's a requirement to understand, who am I standing here? And what is my real service? And how do I remain authentic in the midst of this surge of energy, which, of course, is power? And so back to Prince for a moment. You know, it's sad in how he died or what happened, because culturally, we seem to not know that when someone is being put in the center and people are adoring them, which is the real accurate term for what happens, that they are being imbued as if with big 220-volt electrical, you know, surges. And their psyche has to expand to deal with that. And they have to become way more aware of why they're in that position. And then secondly, the more a person gets exposed to large energies like that, the greater they have to spend their time healing their own inner cracks and splits. Because if they don't, then in a key moment, they will split instead of being a kind of a channel for unity. And you already watch it with Donald Trump, you know, all the time. Under pressure, he splits. And back to Altamont, the only people that could have done something in that crowd were the people who were center stage and the main attraction. And boy, is that a hard thing to do, to say, wait a minute, this was to be a free coming together, you know, for music and love, and now it's turned so quickly towards violence and death. Wait, we have to stop. Wait, we're in the wrong ritual. A person has to learn how to do that. Can't suddenly, you know, do it. Anyway.
Yeah.
You get the point.
Oh, yeah.
We do.
And
we do.
All these energies that are so available now because of mass communication, because So let me just say one other thing. Anybody who shows up at any rally on a psychological level, on a mythological level, is longing to be part of a meaningful human community. That's the reason people show up. Back to the idea of our feet on the ground and our imagination and our spirits way up at the top of the trees. So you put someone up on stage with music, or you put them up there with social ideas, or you put them up there with anything, and people come and look up, and it's as if they're elevating that person in order that that person could connect to something meaningful and bring it down. That's why Prince becomes Prince. He becomes the royalty standing there for that period of time. But two other things have to happen. Whoever I am in the crowd, I cannot give all my power over to that person. I have to somehow remember who I am, or I could find myself on the wrong side of a tragedy. And then for the person who's standing up there, how do they find their rootedness so that they're still authentic? I know you used that word earlier. It's a key word in life. How do I remain authentic while I am becoming kind of like in service of something bigger than me?
Mm-hmm. Wasn't the Temple of Delphi, the big thing was know thyself. I mean, that
yes,
seems to be...
that's the first rule.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the
know
hardest
thyself.
Thing to do.
Yeah, know...
In this culture.
Know thy own gifts and know thy own wounds.
Ah,
important.
Because you watch people get into these positions, it's just, it's so sad because... the more elevated a person becomes, the more their inner split is exaggerated. So they can offer greater and greater stuff, perhaps, and then they go back to the hotel room, and it's all darkness. And there's not a cultural understanding. You go back to the idea of fame. The original meaning, it comes from the Latin fama. And one of the meanings of it is to be seen standing with one's genius displayed. If a person becomes famous and it is not lined up with their authentic, deep self, they're more likely to become infamous. In other words, famous, infamous means famous for the wrong reason.
Right.
And we're watching a lot of that now.
I want to remind folks you are listening to KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting, and we are talking with Michael Mead this morning. Mythmaker, storyteller, lecturer, writer, all-around wonderful person, and frequent guest, actually, at this point. Thank you so much for spending your morning with us. This is actually the first part of a two-part discussion. We'll be back with Michael again next week with more. I also want to remind folks, coming up on KBOO at 9 o'clock, we'll hear part one of a panel discussion carrying on this theme. The 2016 presidential election, Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment, with speakers author Vanessa Williamson and Professor Cedric Johnson. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, and so much more, all packed into 15 minutes. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, there'll be a look at how various dictators, drug traffickers, and other corporate movers and shakers stole $12 trillion from the world's poorest countries and hailed it offshore. At 11, it's part two of that discussion, the 2016 presidential election, Sanders and Trump contest the party establishment. This time the speakers will be Professors Cedric Johnson and Thomas Ferguson. Thanks to everyone who helped KBOO attain our goals for the membership drive. We were ever so close. If you didn't do it yet, please do click the donate button on KBOO.FM and push us all the way over the top. We were just within like spitting distance on Tuesday night at midnight when we ended our spring drive. We have just a few minutes left. The bases are loaded. Michael, let's go ahead and have another call. I think Mike is on next. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, KBOO. Thank you so much for having this teacher on board today. I guess from a personal standpoint, it sounds like what the discussion about could solve so many of the problems around dealing with children, that are diagnosed with ADD or ADHD. Of course, I have a million other things to say and ask, but that's a big enough subject right there. Thank you.
Yeah, very, very important. I have a story in the book. I almost didn't put it in, then I thought, you know, it has to be in there. It's an African story about how killing enters the world. And in the story, what happens is an infant gets killed by its own parents. And because they are fearful and kind of in shock, when a huge eagle comes and settles on the child is crying, and nothing will settle the child. And an eagle descends and rests on the child, and the child immediately goes to sleep. And the father is so shocked, he pulls out his bow and arrows and shoots at the eagle. The eagle lifts its wings and rises, and the infant gets killed. It's a really shocking story, but I explain maybe why they have this story. And it has to do, and I'm not blaming parents, but the idea is, our spirit for life can get killed very early. It can happen in a family when someone, you know, whatever, the people aren't ready for the spirit of that child. And then it can happen in a school where a social situation where people say, you have to act this way, and that child cannot act that way. And now you have, at best, repression of vitality and natural spirit, but at worst, you have a serious distortion starting to happen that causes anguish and so on. And so part of the idea of the genius and why it's so interesting to me is the genius is not the result of the family or the parents. It's a mythological entity inside a person that is just not part of family history, and it's not part of genetics. It's something that really marks that person as unique. And I think if it was better understood, and I'm hearing what Mike is saying, then the child who appears to have an attention deficit disorder might just have a different attention and find their sense of order in a different way. And that if people were watching for that, they might see more of the distinctness or the genius of the child rather than give them a disorder at an early age.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I have to say, it reminds me, when I was in first grade, they made me go to speech therapy so I would lose any traces of an English accent so I could, quote, properly assimilate. And that phrase has stuck with me my entire life. I think I have failed, in fact, to properly assimilate pretty much since the get-go.
I just want to remind folks that Michael is going to be at the, on May 18th, that's a Wednesday, he is going to be at the First Unitarian Church at 7 o'clock talking about the genius myth. So there's more of this that will happen, and there's more of this that will happen next week. We're going to have Michael on again, part deux, and...
Indeed.
Because 1 hour of talking, 1 hour is just not enough.
There's a lot to get into here, especially looking ahead at the long, hot summer. That's going to have some good, thoughtful discussion. So do please join us again next week as we have part two. And Michael, any closing words? We've got about 1 minute left.
Well, it's been a good talk, and I thank you for having me on. I thank people for calling. There's a lot of questions in the air, and people are right, you know, to be looking, where do I go, and how do I turn? And so, again, in the book, I try to deconstruct tabula rasa. Tabula rasa is the philosophical idea that a person is born with a blank slate inside, and then who they become is based on how the world impresses them. And I try to turn that upside down. And say, we have each come here on some kind of an errand. And the errand is to really deliver the gifts that we were given. That the gift of life is not general. It's always specific. And each person is unique. In the midst of these big surges that are going to be going on for a while, knowing where my uniqueness
lies, what shape it is, how I could contribute, can be like the eagle settling the child. It can be this very settling thing that comes from a surprising place. And so that's what I've been working on. And as you said earlier, I've been working with at-risk people of all kinds for 40 years.
Right.
And the idea of genius is one of the few things that I found could work with battle veterans, with refugees, with severely at-risk youth, and with people who are older but could be elder if they imagined that as an elder they would still be contributing before they die rather than just kind of fading away.
And that's where we're going to have to leave it until next week.
We are out of show. Thank you so much, Michael. We'll talk to you in a week.
Thank you both. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Follow along on Facebook. You can like us, Positively Revolting. You can follow along on Twitter, at Positive Revolt. Let's discuss genius throughout the week. And then, you know, next week we'll be back with Michael. Take care.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th Annual Global Cannabis March and Rally, Saturday, May 7th, from noon to 6 p.m., with the march beginning at 4 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. Nearly 300 cities worldwide will participate in this annual global cannabis event. Locally,